Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to bring into focus a few issues in this case for you. I don't intend to re-argue everything, but I think there's a few points to highlight to allow the court to really drill down to the decision points. The first thing I'd like to focus on is the use of the phrase strict liability. This appears in the Court of Appeals opinion in this case. It also appears in some related cases, the Edwards case in particular. The courts are using this label of strict liability in an effort to differentiate these ordinances from some of the other ordinances you're going to hear about today. And this labeling really misses the mark. Strict liability is a reference to the absence of intent as an element. I would refer the court to your decision in Garland versus Department of Revenue, 961 Southwest 2nd, 824. It's not in the brief. This is something that I've been thinking about in the last few weeks. It's a point of clarity I think that needs to be made. Virtually all traffic ordinances are strict liability ordinances. The intent of the offender is irrelevant. Did you run a stop sign, didn't you? Did you have your plates renewed, or didn't you? Intent is irrelevant. What differentiates...
Well, if you run a stoplight, it's strict liability for the person who runs the stoplight. Is it strict liability for the owner?
You're correct. That's the difference, and that's what I want to drill down to, is that difference. But the key point that differentiates the Moline Acres Ordinance from the others that you'll hear about today is the presumption that's employed. And the presumption employed in the Moline Acres case is the presumption that the owner of the vehicle has consented to its use. This is a presumption that was approved by this court in the Hertz versus Kansas City decision. It's not a presumption that the owner was actually operating the vehicle, and that goes to your question.
Well, that would imply that you could show that you had not consented as a defense, but that's not listed as one of the six or seven affirmative defenses.
Actually, Judge, there are defenses that apply to this, and that was the next point I was going to make.
But lack of consent is not one of them.
No, it is, in fact, because you can submit an affidavit that your car was stolen, therefore you didn't consent to its use. You can submit an affidavit that you had already sold the vehicle and therefore had not consented.
But you can't submit an affidavit that you consented, that you did not consent.
You cannot submit the preliminary affidavit that allows you to avoid further proceedings, but you can stand before the trial judge and say in testimony, Judge, I did not consent to the use of this vehicle.
And where in the ordinance, I'm asking you specifically, is that a defense?
It doesn't specifically outline lack of consent as a defense. It allows you to present any and all defenses to the municipal judge
for their discretionary consideration. So it's, I mean, I'm just wondering, I noticed right. that in reading the brief that you said there are various affirmative defenses, but consent I noticed was not one, or lack of consent, but you said that it's the premise of the ordinance is that holding the owner liable is that you've consented to its use. That seems to disconnect between the two, and if you just depend on that catch-all or you can argue anything else to the judge, doesn't that lead to subjective and arbitrary decision making? In some cases it'll be accepted and some it won't.
Well, no, I think we can entrust the judges to not be arbitrary. The distinction is the ordinance is following the Hertz criteria and allowing various ways for the person who's receiving the notice to avoid further proceedings. So the affidavit process is a simplified way of saying either there was no underlying violation, which are some of the justifications that you see, or my car was stolen and I reported it to the police, therefore I did not consent to its use. However, if your car was stolen, let's say your child was grounded, you took the cars away, the keys away, you hid the keys, and you had a recalcitrant child that stole the keys from you and used your vehicle. Can you stand in front of the municipal judge and say, Judge, I did everything I could to not allow my child to use my car? Yes, you can make that testimony.
And what makes that a defense that would keep you from getting a conviction, though?
Because the ordinance requires, as a violation, that the use was permitted, that there was consent.
And that's where I'm asking you, where I don't see any place that it says that. I understand you say that. And I don't see where it's at. I don't want to belabor this point too much, but
it doesn't
set that up.
This is a critical point. The ordinance uses the word permission. The violation is that the owner permitted the use of their vehicle.
Okay.
It doesn't use the word consent, but they're interchangeable.
Okay.
Well, let's say a young man, maybe not myself, maybe I didn't, snuck the car out after his parents were asleep. He had permission to use the car, but he snuck the car out after his parents were asleep. And my father gets a ticket because the car is in my father's name. So my father comes in and says, You know, I didn't give permission exactly. I gave permission to use the car, but he wasn't supposed to be out that night. Is that a defense?
I think it's a defense that can be articulated to the trial judge and be evaluated. You know, one of the reasons that the affidavit allows the reported theft as a way out is there's no opportunity for collusion there. If somebody's gone to the trouble of calling the police saying my car's been stolen, it's pretty straightforward. You're going to have to trust a municipal judge or a circuit judge on de novo review to evaluate the evidence. Did somebody actually take control of their vehicle, or is this just, you know, trying to wipe away a violation? But the testimony is legitimate.
Let's move to the alleged conflict between the state statute and the ordinance. And, you know, your reliance on Hertz is clearly a parked vehicle, not a moving violation. And what we're talking about here, running a stop sign, I see as a moving violation. What's your argument on that?
And actually, this is a speeding case, but your point is the same, and I understand the question you're raising. So the owner is being charged for unsafe supervision of their vehicle. It's not a moving offense. They're not being charged with speeding. Their car was speeding. Yes, their car was in motion. But that's not the charge that they're receiving. They're receiving a citation for not supervising their vehicle correctly. It's not a moving violation. There is no conflict. The other point that's really critical here, that's just missed in all these opinions, municipal courts try ordinance violations. They do not try statutory violations. The speeding statute, which controls speeds on state highways and allows cities to set speed limits on state highways within their borders, has nothing to do with the ordinance violation of speeding in that city. If in this case, if Mr. Brennan had been pulled over by a police officer for speeding, he would have been charged under an ordinance for speeding. And he would have faced potential of 2 points, not three, because even the point system differentiates between the ordinance violations and statutes. But in this case, the charge is unsafe supervision of your vehicle.
But counsel, it's not unsafe supervision of the vehicle. It's to permit their motor vehicle to be operated at a rate of speed in excess of the posted speed limit.
Correct.
So it's failing to ensure, permitting it to be used to speed.
Correct.
But it's not for speeding, you're saying.
Correct.
And if the court doesn't buy that fine slicing of reading, do you lose, or do you have a backup argument on that? I mean, if all the courts of appeals other than the first one have said it is for speeding, it's allowing your vehicle to be used for speeding, and the city has found that's a safety violation. If this court were to adopt that rationale, and it may or may not, what then is your answer to that?
If it has to be a moving, the underlying decision was that you can't have this owner responsibility because of the statute, and the statute's not on point whatsoever. This is a question of ordinances in municipal court. But to your question specifically, if the court concludes that you can't accept this idea that the owner's being held responsible separately from the motion of the vehicle, then it comes down to whether points need to apply or not.
If we rule consistently with the Court of Appeals, where does that leave the municipal ordinance system compared to the state system?
I think it's really going to create just a massive confusion. I mean, if you read the transcript, you know, from the trial judge who's familiar with ticket cases of all kinds, it's like this, there's nothing unusual about this.
If we rule that there is a conflict between a municipal speeding ordinance and a state speeding statute, would that be consistent with our determination that you can have multiple offenses in state crimes for the same conduct, and that it's discretionary with the prosecutor as to which offense to charge? I mean, if in fact there can be only one offense, and if you have more than one offense for particular conduct, if that makes it a conflict, doesn't that apply also to state law where different conduct is applicable to more than one offense?
Well, the problem we would face is that the statute says that a municipal judge can only hear ordinance violations.
Correct.
And specifically, further says, if there's going to be a state charge of a crime instead of a civil charge of an ordinance violation, you have to refer this away. You can't continue the proceedings. So we're talking about eliminating the municipal court system.
Well, I think they're just saying, I'm sorry, Judge Draper.
No,
Title.
Could you have, then if someone is speeding and not the owner of the vehicle, you could have two charges. Your goal is dealing with the owner, not with the speeder. You could have a charge against the speeder for speeding and a charge against the owner for not monitoring their vehicle.
It's certainly theoretically possible that the driver goes past the camera system at 11 miles over the speed limit and keeps going, and 5 miles down the road gets pulled over by a police officer and gets a ticket handed to him. That's certainly possible, yes.
Counsel, as I understand it, there are multiple arguments of conflict, and one is whether or not the owner-operator distinction is a valid one that we've been discussing. The other is that the state statute says that all municipal ordinance violations for moving violations shall be assessed 2 points, and that the municipality has to forward information about the violation to the state for the assessment of points, and your ordinance does not require that, and that's a separate conflict, that it does not provide for points and that it does not provide for forwarding that information.
Well, what I would submit to you is virtually no traffic ordinance specifically says report this for points. It's a separate factor, and that goes to our question of if you're going to find that the failure to report it for points in this instance was a violation and made it unlawful as applied, that still doesn't strike down the ordinance. It just means that in the future the city needs to report these violations to the state for the assessment of points.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is if this court were to find that it was a moving violation,
right?
The state statute says that moving violations require all other municipal ordinance moving violations require the assessment of 2 points. And I think maybe you've made an argument that, well, it doesn't say speeding red light camera or speeding cameras, but there are some of the briefs that have done in that one.
Right, that's not the point that I was trying to make. But I was just distinguishing that different points are assessed for statute versus ordinance violations.
Is there any basis under state law for not being required to comply with the statute that requires reporting an assessment of 2 points if we were to find it was a moving violation?
Well, you're going to hear substantial argument in the next two cases about the statutes that bear on the point system.
Okay.
My point is just that even if after all these arguments you reach the conclusion that it must be reported, it doesn't invalidate the ordinance. It may invalidate this particular charge for not reporting it. It doesn't invalidate the ordinance as written, because like all traffic ordinances, it's silent on this topic.
Now, I assume that the speeding obviously is for public safety. You don't want people speeding, and speeding laws are there, so there's some control over that. And so the assumption is the purpose is you controlling the owner, and the owner of the vehicles, you might have some impact on the speeding. And if the owner's not speeding, it's the speeder that's speeding, and so the owner is not the one with a moving violation. The owner of the vehicle is not the one who's moving, who's speeding, the car is speeding.
But it's their vehicle, they're responsible for it, they're getting a charge, they have to respond to that charge, it may cost them a fine, it gets their attention, they pay more attention to their vehicle, you know, and there's a lot of different issues here. You know, you're not taking the driver's photo, which a lot of people object to the idea of having their photo taken in their car. That's one of the things that the local legislative bodies are weighing, and you'll have a case where they reached the other conclusion and said that we should take the driver photo. Using the system, one of the most important benefits of it is the vehicle doesn't get pulled over to the side of the road, and the police officer doesn't have to get out and walk next to a vehicle on the side of the road. You know, officers lose their lives in this country standing on the sides of roads, and it's one of the main benefits of using traffic enforcement. And it doesn't impede traffic, because now you don't have a car stopped in the middle of traffic that everybody's trying to get around, and the problems that come from that. So there's a lot of other policies.
Thank you, Mr. Lumley.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You have 3 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Eastwood.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Hugh Eastwood, and I represent the respondent in this matter, Charlie Brennan, who is here today. And I represent Mr. Brennan together with Mr. Schock. We actually are co-counsel on all three camera traffic cases today. I'm just here to talk about Brennan. And the record in Brennan is different than the other cases. It's a much more limited record. We're here on a motion to dismiss that was granted by the trial court, by the circuit court on de novo review. And there were three stipulated facts. One, that the car was going 11 over the limit. Number two, that Mr. Brennan is the sole owner of the car. So we don't have some of the equal protection issues that come into some of the other cases. And the third fact is that the city has no idea who was driving the car. Notwithstanding that, of course, Mr. Brennan was charged as the owner of the car. And so
now we have laws regarding property. For example, if you don't keep your house in order, I mean, if you don't keep your yard in order, the grass is too tall or something, then the owner of the house is charged with that crime, or if it's not painted. Yet they may not be the person responsible. It might have been the daughter who was supposed to mow the lawn, or someone else was supposed to paint the house, but the owner is still responsible.
Absolutely, Judge Teitelman. And in fact, I think the real property cases actually probably do shed some light. Particularly, there's one case that is not in the briefing. It is City of Webster Groves v. Erickson.
Just apply us to cases that aren't in the briefs by letter if you want to rely on them. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, and I will, that case is 789 Southwest 2nd 824. It's an Eastern District case from 1990. And I'm happy to submit a letter on that case. But the point is in those cases, the conviction was thrown out, the criminal conviction in the Webster Groves Municipal Court was thrown out for nuisance because there was no proof the owner had actual or constructive notice of the violation. And the city had to prove up actual or constructive notice of the violation, and there were good policy reasons for that. That this was in a landlord-tenant context where the landlord is, you have to show, has some notice either of the tenant's unlawful activity, and the point of that, of course, is to encourage the landlord to be careful.
So if the owner is notified of that their car was speeding, that'd be okay, whether or not the owner was driving the car or not.
Yes, and I think there's policy reasons for that because the legislature made clear in the speeding statutes that this is criminal conduct, and there's a rational nexus between punishing the speeder for criminal conduct and public safety goals by reporting points, by encouraging speeders to obey the posted speed limit. I don't get the rational nexus between.
But if the city of St. Louis has a housing code, that's a legislature, the Board of Aldermen, they have a housing code, and they say, all houses are supposed to come up to certain conditions, and if you don't do it, then you're violating the housing code, and you're liable to a fine and possibly other penalties.
Yes, but after notice and an opportunity to correct. The city has to actually show that the owner knows or constructively knows of the offending conduct. And I would suggest that a house that is not up to code is somewhat different than a car that at a certain point in time is moving too fast through time and space, and then a few minutes later may be parked on the side of the road. The offending conduct is over.
Your opponent argues this as a failure to supervise case. Do you see this as a speeding case or a failure to supervise case?
I see this as a speeding case because the essential conduct that's being penalized here is speeding. That is the underlying criminal conduct at state law. The ownership seems to be a way, I don't get, there's an ownership element, and the word that the ordinance uses, permit. Although this word did not come up in the briefing today, the city spoke of consent, but it's not clear to me that until the colloquy today, that the consent issue really is dispositive, either under the ordinance, the affirmative defenses applied by the ordinance, or as a procedural matter, because I think under a quasi-criminal prosecution, and that at the minimum is what we have here, because we are prosecuting an offense that includes the criminal conduct of speeding. Under that, it's not for the defendant to
have. Is the standard lower on a quasi-criminal? What is a quasi-criminal or quasi-civil offense? Is it the standard lower for due process or or is it the same as a criminal case?
To be honest, I don't know. The ACLU speaks about that in its brief. It talks about Rule 33, 37 in the form of the notice and invites this court not to even go so far as to do a Mendoza-Martinez analysis, which may address the level of process that is required. And perhaps this is not the case in which to reach that determination, because here you have a notice of violation or two, rather, that are clearly deficient under the rules, and the rules are need to be substantially complied with, and they're not being substantially complied with.
Doesn't the violation, as opposing counsel points out, says it's a violation for the owner to permit their motor vehicle to be operated at a rate of speed in excess of the posted speed limit. So is one of the elements of their claim that you permitted it to be operated in an excessive speed? It says, so why would that be an affirmative defense? It sounds like it's part of their burden of proof initially.
Well, I think so far the city has taken the position that it is, does not need to prove up the consent issue. If it's changing its position, then obviously then it I don't know if that's...
I was asking about your position.
Okay, fair enough. My position is that the city has to prove up that the owner gave permission for the car to be used. And that is not a permissible rebuttable presumption in the context of a moving violation.
Is that consistent with our parking cases? Then would there be a requirement that you have to prove that the owner gave permission for their car to be parked illegally?
I believe it's consistent not only with the parking cases, which are limited to parking by their own language, but also consistent with state statutes regarding moving violations, which are criminal in nature and therefore put the entire burden of proof on the prosecution and not on the defendant. And I would also point out that if you look at the statutes and you read them harmoniously, that there are two carve-outs really for vicarious liability on owners. One of them is for school buses, Jessica's Law. This is a rebuttable presumption, and the statute expressly claims that this is a rebuttable presumption. Whether that is acceptable is a separate question. That's not the question for this court today. It is a rebuttable presumption, and it also raises, interestingly, under its own terms in 302.050, this issue of equal protection, that if the car or vehicle is titled with more than one owner, you can only prosecute one owner. And that's an issue that is not before the court on Mr. Brennan's case per se, but it is an issue that is lurking out there in all these cases, and particularly in the Roeder case you're going to get to later this morning.
Now, there's no requirement in the municipal ordinances to have points assessed. If the municipal ordinance was amended to require points to be assessed, the 2 points for speeding in the municipality, then is the conflict between the ordinance and the statute gone?
Not entirely, but as to the points issue, here the ordinance is silent on points, but the notice of violation says no points shall be assessed. And I think the Court of Appeals has been right on this issue so far, and also the case law supports that reading, because Ostiak in particular suggests that that a municipal ordinance speed limit itself is incorporated into the state statute. And so you can't really pull apart these strands of state statutory speeding enforcement and municipal ordinance speeding enforcement, because in many cases, particularly in our urban areas, it is the city or
Mr.
the county.
Where's the conflict left then? If points are assessed, where's the conflict then?
The conflict is that the owner is being prosecuted, or there is a rebuttable presumption that the owner gave permission. And that rebuttable presumption or strict liability, and I'm confused because, quite frankly, I think the city's position has changed on this, respectfully.
Wait a minute. Where's the presumption that they gave consent? It wasn't very long ago when you said that was an element of their case to prove that the owner gave consent.
Correct.
Where's the presumption?
The presumption has been at the trial court level, the city took the position that it did not need to know the identity of the driver.
Okay, but they do know the identity of the owner.
Yes.
And it's the owner that's charged.
Correct.
So what's being presumed?
The presumption is that the owner gave consent, and I think that's impermissible burden shifting to...
Well, where is that? Because you can't have it both ways. It's either presumed or it's an element of their case. So if it's presumed, where is in the ordinance does it say that that fact is presumed, and what's the fact that creates that presumption?
If the it is my permission that it is my position that the city has to prove as an element of their case the owner's permission.
Are you saying that below they didn't do that? They asked for a presumption.
Yes, because they
what
they,
happened below?
Well, it was dismissed, so there wasn't any proceedings that are approved.
I think if you look at the transcript and the three stipulated facts that we don't know the identity of the driver, that was implicit. We don't need to know the
But the was there stipulated that it was being driven with the permission or consent of the owner?
No, Judge Smith, it was not. But I believe it's difficult to show express permission or actual constructive knowledge if you can't prove up the driver's identity. Perhaps you can, but that we're getting far afield then. We know that you gave permission to John Doe or Jane Doe to drive the car. I'm not sure how the city...
Well, perhaps it was dismissed because there was nothing showing they permitted the motor vehicle to be used at speed.
Well, the order from the circuit court shows that it was although these issues were raised in the briefing, of course, at the circuit court level of the motions to dismiss, it was dismissed because of this conflict with state statute. The issue to the circuit court was that this essentially made a civil infraction out of what is criminal conduct at state law, because speeding itself is criminal.
But wouldn't that invalidate then most movie? I mean, almost every city has ordinances, not camera ordinances, mm-hmm. where you're stopped and they're not treated as criminal. They're treated as quasi-criminal or civil in most instances.
I believe that if the underlying conduct is criminal in nature, then criminal due process rights need to apply.
So if we accept your argument, then does that invalidate virtually all municipal ordinances for traffic violations?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't invalidate as long as the ordinance are consistent with the state statutes regarding moving violations. I don't think they are invalidated. It may affect the level of due process that is required for the municipal court to give to the defendant, but that's a separate issue. And again, that's not even presented here in Brennan.
And what do you mean consistent with the state?
Well, that reporting of points, of course, is the biggest one. And the second one is that if you look at the statutes as a whole, they place the liability on the operator or driver. And if you look at the ordinance, it talks about the duty of owners to ensure that their car is not used in a dangerous manner. But that duty does not appear in the statutes. In fact, if you look at 304.012, the highest degree of care goes to the operation of a car. 304.014, the duty is for the operator or driver to follow the rules of the road. And so if you read the traffic statutes harmoniously, you're penalizing the operator, you're placing duties on the operator, and you're imposing penalties, not regulatory burdens, but penalties on the...
Mr. Lumley says that no municipal ordinances set out the points to be imposed. Rather, it's the effect of the state statute. Is that a misstatement?
The reporting scheme, this is not the best case to address the reporting scheme. I believe the Roeder case is the better case for that, Judge. But I will say this, that both the cities and the states have an obligation to follow state law on this, and that the state that imposes duties or affirmative burdens on both the prosecuting
cities. So no cities have read the state statute as requiring them to include in municipal ordinances an actual requirement that points be assessed?
I cannot answer that. I'm only familiar with the red light camera ordinances, and even the ordinances that are before this court, they vary as to whether or not they say expressly no point shall be assessed. I'm not, and if it is the custom and practice of certain municipalities to say that, I don't know if that's the question really for the court, however, because one of the issues is that you have to follow state law. Whether or not your ordinance says that, I don't know if that's relevant.
But an argument we made is not for the city to make the argument. The argument we made by the owner that the penalty is against the owner for allowing someone to drive the car too fast, and therefore the owner shouldn't get points. They could challenge that at the appropriate place where they're getting assessed points.
I would agree with that, Judge Teilman. I know I've gone over my time, but I would just say that absolutely the owner, if he's receiving points, would have standing saying it's irregular under these state process contemplated for assessment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eastwood.
Judge Teilman, to your question, are the standards lower? Yes, the standards are lower. Expressly, Rule 37.41 says that defects in the information in municipal court do not derail the proceedings unless there's substantial prejudice. This court just denied transfer in the St. Louis County versus Hyman case at the end of September, where the court applied that rule and said even though St. Louis County had failed to specifically identify the ordinance number, the party had adequate notice because it said, you know, things like the weeds were too hot. You know, it gave the details even though it didn't cite the code. And so this court and the Court of Appeals have just enforced that rule yet again, saying municipal court proceedings are not criminal proceedings. It's a completely lesser standard. The paperwork doesn't have to be perfect.
Denial of transfer means nothing here, just like in the U.S. Supreme Court. So we haven't done anything.
Well, I'm just saying that the opinion is final. I mean, the Court of Appeals held that that's what the rule stands for, and that's a final decision now as of the end of September.
Is there a presumption being employed under this ordinance? And if so, what is it?
Yes, and I was just going to turn to that question. The presumption comes from, first, the Hertz case saying that you can presume that the owner has consented to the use of their vehicle, and then the legislature confirmed and further authorized the use of that presumption both as to parking and as to operation of vehicles. And so the ordinance is applying that presumption, and again, going
to the question. Where did the legislature do this?
In Section 304.120.
Which it says what?
Which adds this pro, it says you can use the presumption, except you can't do it if it's a rental situation and the rental car company identifies who they rented the car to. But otherwise,
it doesn't say anything about other situations, does it? It just talks about the rental cars.
It's creating an exception to a rule. You don't need an exception if there's no rule.
It doesn't say there's a rule and this is an exception, does it? It just talks about the rental cars.
Is
that correct?
I believe that the wording is, in fact, in this circumstance, you can't do this, otherwise you can. I mean, that's what the statute is saying.
What you're saying is that the statute would have no purpose if there
you
was
can't
not
do
a
it.
Rule.
Correct.
It would be superfluous.
So is it your position that you have to prove consent by the owner to the use of the automobile?
No. We're applying a presumption that as owner, you've consented to the use of your vehicle, and you're allowed to either submit an affidavit of very specific excuses, or you're allowed to testify if you choose in front of the municipal judge and say, I did not consent to the use of my vehicle.
But it's an element. Whether you had to write it this way is a different question. It doesn't say that the vehicle is used at an excessive rate of speed. It says it shall be a violation for the owner to permit their vehicle to be operated at an excessive rate of speed. Whether or not you had to put in that permit language, you did.
Correct.
You've made it an element of your claim, not an affirmative defense.
No, it is an element of the claim that's proved initially by the use of the presumption, thereby shifting the burden of persuasion. But yes, absolutely, I agree.
Okay.
It's an element of the claim.
So my defense is that I told my wife not to speed.
I'm not sure that one would fly.
Why not? I didn't consent to her speeding.
Because you're responsible for your vehicle.
Well, that would be a question of fact for the trier
but
of fact, isn't it?
I'm just giving my opinion, but you know, any judge will make their own decision, obviously.
So they might disqualify you on the jury then, if it went to.
Well, pretty much every time.
I'm just kidding.
It's not an insubstantial question. If a trial judge said that dismissed the charge because there was no proof of the presumed fact after it had been rebutted, where Judge Draper testifies he told his wife not to speed, would that be an error? Can a trial judge dismiss the charge?
No, I don't think that would be an error. I think the burden of persuasion does shift back at some point, you know, in the trier of fact's mind. Absolutely. Thank you.
Mr. Lemley.
We've had in a civil context, I remember a case where a blind person owned the car and obviously can't drive, and her nephew was driving the car and got in an accident. We said, the owner was in control, whether she's blind, had a license, or didn't have a license. She's responsible for the car and the accident.
On a negligent entrustment theory.
Right.
Well, because
right.
the person was in the car in that case, so they had.
But she's blind and can't drive and never could drive and had no control over the. But that we lived in the
it just makes the point that owners are held responsible for their property.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Lemon. The matter will be taken under submission.